Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Good day, everybody. This is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OnFit, and it's a great pleasure to be reintroducing Professor Charles Goodhart from the London School of Economics to talk about the book that he and Manoj Pradhan wrote in a very, very timely fashion. It came out in the summer of 2020, The Great Demographic Reversal. And it's really about how the world is going into a new phase where inflation will be back on the agenda. Aging societies will cause large socio-political strains, and there'll be waning inequality, not rising inequality. And we did a podcast on this exactly a year ago, where Charles and Manoj gave their view, astonishingly prescient, and I do hope we can revisit that. Maybe people would like to go back to that after they've listened to this one, just to see how timely and prescient Charles and Manoj have been. So, Charles, everybody is now talking about inflation. They weren't a year ago, and they weren't 2 years ago when you actually finished the book after many years of research. What do you think has changed to make this now back very burningly on the agenda?
Well, very obviously, inflation has spiked up very strongly, much more strongly than central banks had predicted in all the major Western countries. In the US, it's now over 7%. It will shortly be over 7% in the UK, and it's over 5% in the European area.
Are you surprised that this has happened quite as quickly as this?
No, it's what we thought would happen, though it has been driven on in part by something that had been unforeseen at the time when we wrote the book, which was a spike in energy prices, in some large part caused by the problem with Ukraine. And that has led to a short-term a greater surge in inflation than I think than we or anyone else had expected earlier. But we had always expected that there would be a recovery and that this would lead to much tighter labor markets and that the tighter labor markets would lead to higher wage demands, which they would get, and higher unit labor costs, which would lead to a wage price spiral beginning to develop, as it is now happening, particularly in the US and the UK.
You've postulated in your book, after a lot of deep research, that you thought that demography would play a big role in the revival of inflation, simply because labour markets would become tight. And you postulated that there wouldn't be anything like sufficient immigration from countries like Africa or the Middle East to make up for this, because politics just wouldn't allow that. The tightening of the labour markets and what you might call the Phillips curve effect that we're seeing, has that been somewhat surprising? Because even in the euro area, where we always tend to think there's a lot of slack, people are now starting to think that we're getting near full employment in the euro area, even though unemployment is still 7%. Is that not somewhat surprising that we're seeing this tightening, maybe partly because of the effects of COVID?
Yes, and in the UK during the effects of Brexit, which led to a large outflow of European migrants who had come into this country to work. But it was very interesting that the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, is now actually forecasting that immigration into the UK, despite Brexit and all of that, is actually going to be higher over the next few decades than they'd earlier thought. One factor in that is that we're expecting quite a large inflow of Hong Kong, of refugees from the new regime in Hong Kong. And the ONS has been revising and the Office for Budget Responsibility has been revising its population statistics. It's only because of immigration that we're going to have a population over the next few decades that will rise rather than fall. And indeed, it's immigration, such as it is and forecast to be, is actually critical in maintaining the working age population in this country.
Yeah, that is really rather counterintuitive, isn't it? It's just one of the unseen consequences of geopolitics. But let's just go into central banks, because I want to really focus this podcast on what you might call the reaction function of three central banks, the Fed, the ECB and the Bank of England, all of which you know pretty well. You've been saying for years that central banks should have enjoyed the time of independence over the last 30 or 40 years because it's now coming to an end. Do you see that thesis in any way underpinned by what's been happening with the Fed? The Fed does seem to be getting quite steely now. They didn't take these warnings very seriously last year. I'd like your view whether you think that Mr. Powell's willingness to be renominated might have played a role in that. But the Fed does seem to be biting the bullet at the moment. What do you expect from the Fed in coming months?
I think that's very well. There's no question it's going to tighten. That's absolutely clear and certain. The question is how strongly they're going to tighten, or to put it another way, whether the increase at their meetings is going to be 25 basis points per meeting, or whether they might try and bring about a quicker decline in this inflationary spike and introduce 50 basis points at least at some meetings. One of the difficulties about trying to bring the inflation momentum down rapidly is that this might lead to a really sharp decline in financial asset prices and as a result could lead, together with the pressures on real wages, to a recession. I was at a recent discussion recently by Alan Blinder of his recent book on whether the Fed could engineer soft landings, that is, whether they could reduce inflation without bringing output into decline. And the answer was that it is pretty rare and pretty difficult for the Fed to do that. In most of the cases since the 60s, when the Fed has tried to restore rising inflation back to its target, the answer has been that there has been some degree of recession. And I think the question or the independence of the Fed is how far the pressures on them from the politicians might become greater as the increase in interest rates bite on the economy, bite on financial markets, before they necessarily bring about the reduction in inflation. The next year or so is going to be very, very difficult for central banks everywhere.
Yes, when we spoke a year ago, you did postulate the second half of 2022, where there might be a gap opening up between the Treasury and the Fed over whether it was wise to put on the brakes. At the moment, one can't detect any great controversy from the White House or from the Treasury about what the Fed says it's going to do. But it's only early days yet. Do you think as we get towards the midterm elections that Mr. Biden will turn a slightly more Trumpian, shall we say, in becoming nervous about the Fed? Or do you think that Biden will just keep a pretty cool demeanor, which he's shown generally about Fed affairs, but of course he hasn't really been tested yet?
I think that's very difficult to say. It is probable that the Democrats are going to have a pretty rough time in November, almost come what may now, because inflation will still not be back to target. It will have spiked. People will have that in their memory. And financial markets are going to be in much more difficulty. And the situation is going to look a bit unhappy, as it always does at this particular stage in the cycle. Now, quite how the politicians will react to that. Fortunately, the Secretary of the Treasury, now Yellen, has at least a complete and thorough understanding of the problems that the Fed is facing. But quite how the President will react, I don't know. And how the rest of the Democrats will react to what has been clearly a sort of failure of central bank forecasting and policies to head this really very difficult juncture off at the pass. And they didn't do it. They didn't see it. And the result could well be something of a disaster for the administration come November.
Well, we'll wait and see about that. But of course, there is a history of presidents suffering at the hands of the Fed, either directly or indirectly. Let's turn to the ECB, which is really the most fascinating of them all, because you've got on the one hand what appears to be a very, very strong degree of independence, statutory, constitutionally in a treaty, can only be overturned if every single EU country votes in that way. On the other hand, there's a lot of politics in the appointment process. We've got a new governor of the Bundesbank making some fairly hawkish noises. He's a bit more brutal than Mr. Weidmann, I think, even though he's quite good-humoured, Joachim Nagel. And you've got Christine Lagarde, who's clearly a political animal, who's a very clever lady at the head of the ECB. She's been tipped as a possible prime minister under President Macron, were he to be re-elected in April. And also, unlike the Fed, we've still got a very large asset purchase program, which is continuing at the ECB, even though they're starting to think about possibly raising interest rates from negative levels next year. How do you think all that will play out in the ECB context? As you say, we have 5% inflation now in the euro area.
And as Isabel Schnabel has pointed out in a recent interview with the Financial Times, the inflation in the euro area is actually significantly understated because there is nothing in it for housing prices or rents at all. Housing is completely ignored. And if you take housing into account, the effective inflation in the euro area is even higher. But that said, the euro area is, I think, much more difficult to see and interpret than the US or the UK. And although unemployment in the euro area is now relatively low by historic standards, it's still a great deal higher than in the US and the UK at about 7%. And the question is whether the participation rates and the supply of labor is sufficiently strong still to keep wages from reacting to the rise in inflation. And in the US and the UK, the inflation rates are already sufficiently high with the strong labor market that workers are going to try and restore their living standards by asking for much more money. And given the tight labor market, they're probably going to get it. Means that if you're going to beat inflation, you have to make the labor market less tight, which means more unemployment. That is not yet necessarily true in the euro area. The labor markets are not self-evidently as tight as they are in the US, UK, and it's not yet necessarily true that wages are going to go up as much in response to a pre-existing inflation as they will do in the US and the UK. So there's still quite a lot to play for in the euro area. And the ECB, having been congenitally, like the other central banks, absolutely persuaded that the long-term developments are for low inflation and low interest rates, they are not going to be pushed out of this until they have more evidence of wage rates significantly rising. My guess is that they will, again, because of longer-term demographic developments. There's a sort of massive inherent shortage of labor in Germany in particular. And I think that the conditions in labor markets in Europe more generally are tightening sufficiently to involve such higher inflation that the ECB will be forced to respond and fairly soon. But that remains uncertain, whereas in the US, the UK, the wage price spiral is already underway.
a former policymaker in Europe said to me very recently that during the time when COVID was on the rampage and also when inflation in the euro area was manifestly low, you could maintain negative interest rates and also large asset purchases for good reasons. But now both of those factors are being stripped away. And this person says you reveal that the reason why you need to do that is actually because of worries over the continuation of the sovereign debt crisis, i.e. if interest rates were to go up, it could harm heavily indebted countries like Italy. And you'd be left with the old problem of how to maintain a Europe of several different speeds when you have creditor and debtor countries trying to coexist together. Do you think, therefore, that even this rather modest and rather slow tightening that you're envisaging could reveal yet again some of the underlying frailties and deficiencies and fault lines in the euro area?
The answer to that is obviously yes. But on the other hand, the longer that the ECB waits to change policies, it is possible that the higher that interest rates would have to go in order to keep inflation under control. So it's a question of a balance of risk. I would argue that they ought to be moving interest rates now in order to prevent them having to move interest rates much more and much more sharply in future. In other words, yes, the risk of inflation and higher nominal interest rates putting strains on the euro system is very obvious. But I think that the balance of risk suggests moving quicker and slower rather than faster and later.
Yes, this is the monetary equivalent of a stitch in time saves nine. And it's certainly what Joachim Nagel, the new president of the Bundesbank, has been saying. Just a last question on the ECB, although it's a very hypothetical one. If Mrs. Lagarde were to go back into politics after only just over 2 years at the ECB, what do you think would be the effect?
Most central banks are broadly based institutions with a very large number of highly competent people. They would simply appoint a new chair who would probably be very good. I don't think it actually makes very much difference. And I don't think that given the importance of the committee system of taking decisions, given the large number of extremely competent and able people at the ECB, as at other central banks, that one person makes all that much difference. We're driven by events. Events, dear boy, as I think Macmillan said, causes the problems and causes the changes in policies. Not people. I have great respect, and I think she's a wonderful woman, but I don't think actually it would matter very much one way or another if Madame Lagarde decided to or was offered a position and moved out of the ECB. The ECB would continue.
No, I think she, at the bottom of her heart, must think that herself. Just the final issue is the Bank of England, institution you know very well, having been on the Monetary Policy Committee all those years ago. The former governor, he earned this reputation rather unkindly, maybe in the words of one Labour MP, of being like an unreliable boyfriend, because you can never really believe what he was saying when it comes to interest rate forecasts. The present governor hasn't done that much better in terms of being a steady, reliable source of documentation about what might happen next. The Bank of England seems to keep people guessing quite a bit. The governor, Andrew Bailey, has recently earned headlines in both the Daily Star and the Financial Times by entreating wages not to go in for wild wage claims. Do you think that the Bank of England is going to have to tighten really quite severely later this year because of what you have just pointed out, the 7% inflation rate? And is that going to cause a lot of pain and strain, including for the government, despite the immigration that you've been talking about, which could make the labour market somewhat less tight? Do you foresee a lot of pain ahead for the UK?
Yes, but again, it doesn't depend on the question of the person of the government. I think the moral of the unhelpful, whatever it was, is don't forecast interest rates because, as a previous governor, Mervyn King, said, we live in a world of radical uncertainty. We simply do not know what's going to happen next. We do not know whether Russia is going to invade Ukraine. We do not know whether China's attempts to defeat Omicron are going to lead to supply chains worsening very strongly. There is a huge amount in our world that we don't know. And that means that forecasting the path of interest rate is a mug's game. You should never, ever do it. And what you do is you tell people how you would react to various, all of them possible scenarios. And all this stuff about forward guidance, maybe it had some sense for a very, very short time before COVID struck. But it's been clear that you can't guide people forwardly. When you and I, we have no idea what's going to happen in the world. If I knew what was going to happen in the world, David, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be a multi-billionaire and I'd be sitting on my own island in the Caribbean. I don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. And the governor of the central bank, whoever she or he may be, they don't know what's going to happen either. And to pretend that you know what's going to happen is just plain stupid.
Well, I agree with you. Of course, you could still be talking to me from your yacht or your ocean liner, Charles. But I agree with you. It's difficult enough to guide us through the next 10 minutes, isn't it? Let alone through the next 10 years. So I've always thought forward guidance is just a bit of a cop-out for saying I don't really know what's going to go on, but I'm not going to tell you. But I'd just like to end on this issue about populism. You made the point in your book, which I do entreat people to reread or to go out and buy, The Great Demographic Reversal by Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan. You say that you think that right-wing governments or more populist governments would be actually much more likely to reverse the independence of central banks than, say, left-wing governments that might see an independent central bank as a useful fig leaf. Could you elaborate on that? And where do you think the shoe would first fall if one were to look for the toppling of central bank independence somewhere around the world? We've seen quite a lot of grinding away at this in some Latin American countries. We've seen it in Eastern Europe. We've seen it in Turkey. Where do you think is really going to bite the erosion of central bank independence in the next few years? I know I'm asking you about the future, but I'm not asking you about interest rates.
And in India, too, of course, where Modi has made it very clear that he wanted various people and not others in the Reserve Bank of India. No, the point is fairly obvious. The thing is that markets and financial markets tend to distrust left-wing governments. And having an independent central bank, in a sense, reassures financial markets. While right-wing governments believe they know more about financial markets and are trusted by financial markets more. And therefore, right-wing governments feel that they can take over control of monetary policy without the kind of pushback from financial collapses that would happen with left-wing governments. And that's been a common thread throughout the whole of the central bank independence exercise. You'll remember that the very first central bank independence was provided by the incoming Labour Party in New Zealand back in the late 1980s. It was provided by the Labour Party in the UK. It's actually a very common phenomenon. And of course, the great danger for American independence would be the re-election of Trump. In fact, any Republican, I think, would put the independence of the central bank at some much greater risk than from a Democratic administration. The situation, of course, as you pointed out, David, is very different and much more complicated in Europe, where the ECB is protected by a treaty. It has a degree of independence that no other central bank can claim. But then, of course, the personnel, the central bank governors of the various countries involved are appointed by government. And so to a large extent, though I find the question of the appointments to the board to be rather opaque, again, there is politics involved in that. So the ECB is undoubtedly the most independent of all our central banks, but the independence is not, shall we say, as cast iron, because it also depends on who gets appointed to the council.
Well, of course, if Christine Lagarde does move to the Matignon in Paris, there will also be a huge question about the nationality, and that's something you don't have in other central banks as well. So there'll be lots for us to talk about, Charles, and no doubt you'll be bringing out a new version of your book, will you? Are you planning a new edition?
No, I'm not, and I'm getting to an age where the likelihood of my writing much more is actually beginning to diminish. The 70s were easy, but when you get into the 80s, David, you actually do notice a degree of increasing physical degeneration. It may creep up on one slowly, but creep it comes.
Well, I think the mighty pen, the sword-like pen, or the typewriter keyboard, or the data machine keyboard in your hand is as strong as ever, Charles, may I say that. And so good luck to you and Manoj for the further success of this remarkable book. And I do applaud you for doing it, even at this elevated age. I look forward to further conversations with you, both through these podcasts, but also in the flesh over a good lunch before too long. So thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and good luck to you and Manoj as you go further on this publishing journey with your book. And look forward to talking again soon, Charles.
Well, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure, as always, being with you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFifth Podcast.